So turn to Exodus chapter 16 with me. So as we've learned so far, we kind of covered this the last couple of weeks here, but when the Lord took Israel out of Egypt, they didn't go by the shortest route. They went by a rather long route. The shortest route, again, would have been along the sea at the north. But the Lord took them through the south. And one of the things that I had shared last week and the week before, that one of the purposes of that was because Israel was not ready to go into the land of promise, the land of Canaan. They had been in Egypt for 400 plus years, and as we had kind of highlighted last week, were probably more Egyptian than Israel at that point. They had been, we find that they had worshipped the gods of Egypt. They took some of those gods with them. They had to be reminded when they were in the wilderness to abandon those gods, and even at other times in their history, as we go through even the period of Judges, and we go into the divided kingdom, and we go into the divided kingdom, we find that they struggled with that. They continually struggled with that. They just sort of didn't really leave Egypt behind. And so the Lord was going to take them through the wilderness. I'm going to mention Doc here just briefly. One of the things Doc had mentioned last week too is that another reason why they spent 40 years in the wilderness was because of their disobedience. And so really have that sort of that twofold issue going on there. God deliberately took them into the wilderness as a way of helping to, I'll say, sanctify them, get Egypt out of them, make them dependent upon him, but also it lasted 40 years because it took them that long, and the Lord did have to discipline them, and we're told that. A little bit later, I believe it's Deuteronomy that says that, numbers actually, where they are told, you're not going in. That generation had to go and stay in the wilderness. They didn't get to go into the land of Canaan because of their disobedience. So we really have that twofold purpose. One of the things that's kind of remarkable about the scriptures is that oftentimes we can turn to other places for explanations of what's happening somewhere else. And we can do that this morning. If you turn to Deuteronomy chapter 8 with me, just turn to Deuteronomy chapter 8. The Lord tells us exactly what he was doing with not just the wilderness, but these three specific events that we're seeing over these 3 weeks. So look at Deuteronomy chapter 8. I'm going to read through the first part of the chapter, maybe a good chunk of the chapter here, but just join me there in Deuteronomy chapter 8. It says in verse 1, "All the commandments that I have commanding you today, and you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give you to your forefathers." That's the purpose and the plan. I want you to live and obey. Trust me when you get into the land. Verse 2, "You shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. He humbled you, and he let you be hungry, and fed you with manna which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord." You all know that. Somebody else said that, didn't they? "For your clothing did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell for these 40 years. Thus, you are to know in your heart that the Lord your God was disciplining you just as a man disciplines his son. Therefore, you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land where you will eat food without scarcity, in which you will not lack anything, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you have eaten and been satisfied, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes, which I am commanding you today. Otherwise, when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herd and your flocks multiply and your silver and gold multiply and all that you have multiplies, then your heart will become proud and you will forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. He led you through the great and terrible wilderness." What a description. "The great and terrible wilderness, with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water. He brought water for you out of the rock of flint." That'll be next week. "In the wilderness, he fed you manna from your father that your father didn't know." That'll be this week. "That he might humble you and that he might test you to do good to you in the end. Otherwise, you may say in your heart, my power and my strength and my hand have made me this wealth. But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who is giving you power to make wealth, that you may confirm his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. It shall come about if you ever forget the Lord your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you today that you will surely perish, like the nations that the Lord makes perish before you. So you shall perish because you would not listen to the voice of the Lord your God. Wow, that's a mouthful. But it's a description of what we're seeing over these 3 weeks and what we will ultimately continue to see in the rest of our study of Exodus. There are three specific events that happened very soon after they left. The first one happened last week, and that was just 3 days after the crossing of the Red Sea. And that's when they grumbled against the Lord because they were thirsty and they didn't have any water. The second event is about a month later, and that's what we're going to talk about today. And that's when they grumble and complain because they're hungry. The next one will be next week, and that's going to be in chapter 17. It's when they grumble against God because they were once again without water and were thirsty. So for our outline today, we're going to look at this event where they're grumbling because they're hungry. We're going to look at it in three parts. The first part is going to be that Yahweh allowed Israel to experience hunger in order to test them. We just saw God describe that in Deuteronomy 8. So the Lord allows Israel to experience hunger because he's going to test them. The second thing we're going to see is that he was gracious and merciful even though they failed the test. Not once, but today alone in our passage, twice. So they failed last week. They're going to fail twice today. They're going to fail again next week. And yet the Lord remains merciful and gracious to them. There'll be a good lesson in that for us. And then lastly, Yahweh had Moses set aside some of the manna that he gave them to serve as a reminder of how they could trust him. And we've seen that repeatedly over and over, how God establishes these ways to remember the lessons that Israel is supposed to be learning. So we're going to look at that in three parts today. Let's start with the first part. Yahweh allowed Israel to experience hunger in order to test them. 3 months into the Exodus, Israel began grumbling again against God. Look at verses 1, 2, and 3 from Exodus 16. Then they set out from Elim. That's important because they had just been given not only water at Marah, but now water at Elim, which, remember what Elim was? How many palm trees were there? The shade in the springs? This was a lush, lush place in a dry, dangerous wilderness. So they had just left that. It says, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came into the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month of their departure from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The sons of Israel said to them, would that we have died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Back in chapter 15, they grumbled just 3 days after leaving, and what did God do? Provides them this great oasis, right? Here, they're actually, if I do my math right, about 1 month into that journey now. I think I said 3 months a little bit earlier, but I think it's only a month that they've now been out of Elim. So 1 month later, verse 2 says that the whole congregation, this wasn't just a handful of rogues, this was everybody. They're all whining and complaining now. It says that they're grumbling. Remember, last week we talked about that, the murmuring. I gave you the example of me doing that to Amy sometimes, you know. Grumbling under our breath, whining and complaining about stuff. And notice who they're complaining against. It says Moses and Aaron. Now, I guess we can understand that because they were the leaders, they were taking them out, but they're just the messengers. You know? They say you don't like the message, shoot the messengers, right? So they're moaning and groaning, they're grumbling against Moses and Aaron. And this time they're groaning not because they're thirsty, but because they're hungry. Now this poses an interesting question, because back in Exodus chapter 12, it says that they left with a ton of livestock. They could have. Well, why didn't they slaughter the livestock, and why didn't they eat? I don't have a good answer for that. The only thing I can think of is that it may have been that the livestock wasn't sufficient to feed 2 million people. You know, we're not really sure. In fact, a little bit later, I think it's Numbers 11. Moses actually is talking to God, and he makes this comment that even if they slaughtered all of the animals, it wouldn't be enough to feed their families. Even if they got all the fish out of the sea, it wouldn't be enough to feed Israel. Now, he's being somewhat over the top there, but the reality of it is maybe there wasn't quite enough to feed everybody. Maybe they realized, too, that they need those flocks for other things. I don't know. But for some reason, they're into this journey about a month here, and they're grumbling because they're hungry. In fact, we know they're hungry. Even though they don't say they're hungry, they are talking about being dead from hunger here. But God tells us they were hungry in Deuteronomy 8. So we know they're hungry. They're complaining because they're hungry. Whatever is going on there, look at how over the top they were. If only they had died by the hand of Yahweh in the land of Egypt. That's a way of expressing a wish or a desire. If only we had died. Remember what that was like? 10 plagues. It would have been better for them to die with one of those plagues than to be in the wilderness and be a little hungry right now. They go on, they're sort of romanticizing what happened in Egypt. Oh, we had pots of meat and we ate bread to the full. I don't know about you, but I'm a little skeptical of that. I mean, they were slaves in Egypt. You know, they're working their fingers to the bone. They have to go out and gather their own straw. I doubt they sat around and had these amazing family meals with wonderful stew in the pot and more bread than they could imagine. They were always full. You know, it's not like Amy and I get to go to Jay Gilbert's or something every single night. That's not the way we eat, right? Sometimes I have lunch meat for dinner just because I don't feel like cooking. Well, they're kind of romanticizing their time back in Egypt. It wasn't that glorious, but for some reason, when they're hungry, everything back home was so much better. Do we ever do that? They even make this accusation against Moses and Aaron that they had simply brought them out to the wilderness for one purpose, to put the whole assembly to death by hunger. Moses, you just brought us out here to kill us. And you don't only do it mercifully and quickly, you're going to make us starve to death. What a horrible way to die. This is over the top. There's a lot of emotion packed into that, isn't there? Again, I don't want to be too hard on Israel here. We kind of get that way sometimes, don't we? You know, our situation we're in and feeling it, you know, and all of a sudden it's really, you know, maybe it's worse than what it really is because we're in the midst of it. We're struggling. What's God's response to this? How does he respond? Look at verses 4 and 5. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instruction. On the sixth day when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So God's response is, "Moses, I'm doing this to test them." God knew about their hunger. He allowed them to be hungry. This isn't just, oh, they happen to be hungry, and so then God steps in and says, "Oh, okay, I can take care of this." No, this is all orchestrated. This is part of God's sovereignty. This is all part of his purpose. In fact, again, the reason I read Deuteronomy 8, God specifically tells Israel, remember that time in the wilderness? Remember the manna that I had to give you? Remember being thirsty? Do you remember being hungry? Do you remember the rock that Moses had to smack with his, or wasn't supposed to smack, but he did? Do you remember all that? I was testing you. I was humbling you. I was teaching you to obey me and to walk in my statutes. This was all a deliberate act of God. Now, we don't like to think of God that way, do we? We don't like to think that God sometimes challenges us or sometimes tests us. God doesn't test. James even says that. God does not test. If you look in the context of that, the idea is that he doesn't test us to fail. He doesn't test us so that we might sin and fall. But he does test us to see what's in our heart and to cause us to grow and to mature. And so he's telling Moses here, "Moses, I'm testing them, but I'm also going to provide for them." And so how does this test work out? One purpose of the test, we see right in verses 4 and 5 there, is whether or not they will walk in my instruction. Now, the word instruction here is the word law, but the idea there is that he's going to give them some instructions on how to deal with their hunger. He's going to provide for them, but it's going to come with some caveats. I'm going to give them food, however, I'm going to test them with that food. There's going to be some instructions on how they manage that food. That's the test. I'm going to see if they're willing to do that. But I think it goes beyond that, because later he's going to give them the law in the wilderness, and he's going to expect that they obey those too. This is just the beginning. So when he says here that he's going to test them to see if they will walk in his ways, it's not just about the bread. This is seeing what their heart is. What they do here with the bread tells me what they're going to probably do later when it comes to the law. It's almost like, I'm going to give them a small test here. If they can't do that, we got a bigger problem down the line. Isn't it kind of like what we do with our kids? We give them small responsibilities. Maybe if they do that, they get bigger responsibilities, right? Even the work environment, you do a really good job at what you're given by your management or your boss, maybe you'll go on and get something else, right? It's a bit of a testing. And so the first responsibility here is that, or the first part of this test is that, would they obey the Lord when it came to his instructions? And what were his instructions? Well, he basically says, I'm going to give them manna. I'm going to give them bread. And every morning I'm going to give them bread. And every morning they're going to go out, and all they can gather is enough they need for that one day, for everybody in their tent, in their household. Now, why is that important? If they're hungry, what's going to be the temptation? I'm going to gather up as much as I can get, right? I don't want to be hungry again. This idea of gather just enough for that day. Well, yeah, but if I do that, I may be hungry tomorrow. I'm going to give you enough for the day. Yeah, but Lord, why don't... No, I'm going to give you enough for the day. But I might be hungry. No, I'm going to give you enough for the day. Go out and gather it for the day. Oh, and then by the way, remember that whole Sabbath thing? I don't want you to do any work on the seventh day. So on the sixth day, I'm going to give you enough to gather for 2 days. Well, yeah, but why can't I just do that every day, Lord? No. Every day, you get to gather enough. But on the last day of the week, the sixth day, you can gather enough for 2 days. That's the rules. I'm going to feed you, but those are the rules. Are you going to obey? The second purpose of the test comes in verses 6 through 8. Look at 6 through 8. So Moses and Aaron said to the people of Israel, at evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. In the morning you will see the glory of the Lord. For he hears your grumbling against the Lord. And that, what are we that you grumble against us? Verse 8. Moses said, this will happen when the Lord gives you meat in the evening and bread to the full in the morning. For the Lord hears your grumblings which you grumble against him. And what are we? Your grumbling are not against us, but against the Lord. So notice what Moses says here. The second purpose of the test was to remind them that God would provide for their needs. Notice what he says here. In the evening, you'll know that Yahweh has brought you out of the land of Egypt. But what would happen in the evening? Quail, meat. Boy, they don't just get bread, they get meat. And so every night, God's going to bring quail upon the land, and they would know when they would see this, this is God providing food for us. We'll see that in a little bit, because when the quail does come, they cover the ground. They're just all over the place. If you're afraid of birds, you'd have a coronary. He then says, in the morning, you're going to see the glory of Yahweh. Well, what happens in the morning? That's when the manna comes. And so every night they would see that the Lord provides in the meat. Every morning they would see his glory by the manna that's provided. And he would do all of this in spite of their grumblings. Did you notice that both the Lord and Moses, as they're talking here, how many times do they use the word grumbling? 4 times. You've got verse 7. It says, your grumblings against the Lord. You look at verse 8. It mentions you grumble against him. Your grumblings are not against us, but against the Lord. Verse 12. I've heard your grumbling. We talk about repetition sometimes. It's trying to drive home a point. I think part of the point here that we can take away from this is that they've been given these instructions, and God is providing for them bread in the morning, meet at night, and he's doing this in spite of their grumbling. What do we do with that? God's desire is that we learn to trust him and walk in his ways, and he allows us to be tested in order to accomplish those things. Did you catch that? God's desire is not to be this cosmic killjoy and just strap us with these rules and regulations. Instead, what he's trying to do is to teach us to trust him and to walk in his ways. But in order to do that, he has to allow us to be tested, allow us to be tried. Again, we talk about Israel. When they came out of Egypt, they were more Egyptian than Israel. We mentioned Leland Ryken last week, a scholar who basically said they needed to get the Egypt out of them. In the same way, as Christians, we kind of have to unlearn what it means to rely on ourselves and to rely on the world around us. As one friend of mine said, to change our stinking thinking. I don't know about you, but I wasn't saved until I was 19 years of age. I had an awful lot of the world in me, the way that I thought, the things that I did, the way that I behaved. That didn't just all change overnight. And the Lord wasn't satisfied to allow me to stay in that condition. Now, I was transformed. I was given a new life in Christ. I was a new creature in Christ. I had been justified. I had been redeemed. But my behavior didn't reflect that. And so God has allowed me at various times in my life to go through difficulties to challenge that, teach me about my ways, and to teach me to learn to walk and to trust him. One of the ways that he does that is by testing us through trials and temptations. Last week, we talked about the book of James, one of my favorite books. He starts off the book, consider it all joy when life is great. Wait a minute, we can probably turn there, we don't have to. But no, it's consider it all joy when you face various trials. Why? He tells us. Because you know the testing of your faith produces what? Endurance, staying power. And why? What good does endurance do me? Well, endurance ultimately helps us to become perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. The goal is to make us more like Christ. And that happens in multiple ways. One, we're given the Spirit to begin with. Second, we learn to grow and walk and reflect Christ. And then third, at some point, when we see Christ, we will be finally completely transformed and be like him. But there's a process in between. Peter told us that trials are necessary to prove our faith so that it might be found to result in praise and glory and honor when Jesus Christ returns. Trials are necessary. It's not like God is just sort of like, nah, you know, I kind of forgot about those. No. God knew what he was doing. Saves us, leaves us in the muck and mire in some respects to walk this earth, but gives us everything we need, right? But he allows us to go through difficult times. There was a song this morning that I heard driving in here. I was trying to see if we could get it downloaded here. I was going to play it for you, which is not something we typically would do. But, man, I was surprised. It was from Leanne Crawford. It was called Thank God. But it was amazing how the song itself, and I'm not saying I agree with everything theologically in it because I don't have enough time to analyze it, but man, she was repeating these themes about, Lord, thank you for letting me walk the difficult road. Thank you for saying no sometimes. Thank you for teaching me to rely on you. And I was like, man, that's all the things we're going to talk about this morning. That's just the reality of it. And just as God revealed himself to Israel through their trials, and just as he was going to do in this episode today where he's going to reveal to them, you can trust me, I can provide for your needs. God does the same thing with us through those trials. I could probably ask any one of you here, think back at a really difficult time in your life and think through, one, did God provide at that time in your life? And two, what did you learn about him? What does it say about him? Did it help you to understand that you can indeed trust him with the next trial? Maybe some of you would say, no, I hope not. I think most of you would say, no, that's true. It's hard to remember those things. But the reality of it is, God allows us to go through difficult times because he's testing us. And the testing is more like what you do with fire. Testing it to purify it, not testing to see if it'll fail. God didn't want Israel to fail this test. Now, unfortunately, as we lead to our second point, Israel did fail the test. And they failed it twice today. But, second point is, Yahweh was gracious and merciful even though Israel failed this test he gave them. Not once, but twice. But God was still gracious and merciful. Look at verses 9 through 12. Then Moses said to Aaron, "Say to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumblings." It came about as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the sons of Israel that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "I have heard the grumblings of the sons of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God." So it came about at evening that the quail came up and covered the camp. And in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the layer of dew evaporated, behold, the surface of the wilderness, there was a fine flake-like thing, as the frost on the ground. I'm going to keep reading. When the sons of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "It is bread which the Lord has given to you to eat. And this is what the Lord has commanded. Gather it every man as much as he should eat, and take an omer apiece according to the number of persons each of you has in his tent." The sons of Israel did so, and some gathered much and some little. When they measured it, an omer with, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no lack. Every man gathered as much as he could eat. Moses said to them, "Let no man leave any of it until morning." So basically what we find here is that the first opportunity to pass this test comes about the next morning. In the morning, when the dew evaporated, there was this fine, like, flake-like thing, it says, covering the ground. Moses described it as fine as the frost on the ground, so you might think of fall time here as we're leading towards winter, and you come up in the morning and you see that mist that's covered the ground and it looks kind of like frost, right? That's what this looked like. Every morning, that's what they saw. No idea what it was, so they called it manna. He says that it's bread which Yahweh has given you to eat, so God had to define it for them. This is the bread. And ultimately what they would do is they would make a bread with it. They would boil it or mix it up, and they'd put it on griddle, and they would cook it. They made a bread out of it. It's kind of like flour. But the instructions that were given was each man could go out and gather enough for his tent. That basically means the people he's responsible for. So that would be things like family, but then any servants they might have had. But that's all they could gather every day. And God gave them a specific amount, an omer per person. That's about 2 to 3 quarts today. And they couldn't gather any more than that, so let's say they basically had 10 people in their tent, they could gather 10 omers. No more, no less. Initially it says, each man did as he was instructed. They went out and they gathered what they needed. Okay, so far so good with the test, right? But there was another part to this, these sets of instructions, and what was that last piece? Well, they weren't supposed to keep any of it until morning, verse 19. Let no man leave any of it until morning. Now, why is that? Remember, you're only to gather what you can eat in the day. If you keep it overnight, that means you want leftovers. Anybody here like leftovers? Can't keep it overnight. Well, look at verse 20. But they did not listen to Moses, and some, not all, but some left part of it until morning, and it bred worms, became foul, and Moses was angry with them. They gathered it morning by morning, every man as much as he should eat, but when the sun grew hot, it would melt. Israel failed the test. Now, the thing we have to keep in mind here, when some in Israel fail, Israel's guilty. We don't like to think that way, but there is a corporate sense when it comes to Israel. Now, it doesn't mean God always treated every Israelite exactly the same as others. There are times where God judges some, but not all. But in a sense, Israel's guilty here. They didn't obey. They kept it overnight. This is like partial obedience, you know? Well, what do we know about partial obedience? Is partial obedience obedience? Nope. When God says do this, it's not like you can say, "Well, how about if I do half of that, Lord? Is that enough?" No. He said, "Go out and gather enough for one day. Anything's left, throw it out." Don't eat it. But somebody decided they wanted leftovers. I'm going to keep it till the next day. It's a lack of trust. It's a lack of faith. It's disobedience. Now, they're given a second opportunity to obey. That was the first one, and they failed that one. The second opportunity comes in verses 22 through 30. We get to the sixth day now, because they've only done it through the first few days now, and they didn't get it right. So now we get to the second half of these instructions. Now on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one. When all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, then he said to them, "This is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a Sabbath observance, a holy Sabbath of the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over put aside and kept until morning." So now this they could keep until the next morning. Why? God provided them with twice as much on the sixth day. So they wouldn't have to gather and bake or boil on the seventh day, because that is to be a day of rest. Remember, that day of rest isn't just about obedience, it's about learning to trust the Lord. Because the Lord has to provide for that day, because we're not going to go out and gather or work or bake. Verse 24, so they put it aside until morning, as Moses had ordered, and did not become foul, nor were there any worm in it. Okay, so far so good, right? Everything's looking good. Moses said, "Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none." So far, so good. It came about on the seventh day that some of the people went out to gather. They found none. You can just imagine them walking around. Where's the manna? Did you not get a clue? Lord made it really clear. It's not going to be here on the seventh day. He said that. He told you to gather twice as much yesterday. Told you not to keep stuff overnight except last night. And you're out there wandering around looking for something you've been told is not going to be there. But you see, it's more than that. It's not just their foolishness. This was outright disobedience. They were told not to go out and to gather. I'm kind of surprised that God didn't put the manna out there, let them touch it, and take their lives. That would have been an announcement, wouldn't it? But he's gracious and he's merciful. In some respects, he didn't allow them to gather manna. But they still went out and tried. Then the Lord said to Moses, "How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions?" That sounds like an accusation against Moses, but again, it's likely treating Moses as the representative of Israel. There's some culpability in some respects. He's saying, "Moses, why are they doing this? How long are they going to refuse to keep my commandments?" Verse 29, "See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you bread for 2 days on the sixth day. Remain every man in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day." So finally in verse 30, so the people then rested on the seventh day. Finally, there's some obedience there. So this second opportunity to pass the test, they fail. They fail the first time. They fail the second time. Finally appear to get it right. Okay, we'll stay in and we'll honor the Lord on the Sabbath. It's hard to miss the mercy and the grace, the long-suffering of Yahweh here, isn't it? I mean, think about this. They grumbled against him when they thought they were trapped up against the Red Sea. They're freaking out. They had just seen all the amazing things God had done. But they get to the Red Sea and they're like, oh no, we're going to die here. But Yahweh rescues them. 3 days later, they are thirsty and, "Oh, there's no water. And what do? They grumble against him again. But what does he do? Gives them water at manna. There's a miracle, turning the bitter water into sweet. And then sends into this amazing oasis. Doesn't that tell us something about God? If it were up to me, I would have just said, here's some water. It's lukewarm. Got a little bit of sand in it. Deal with that. But the Lord didn't. Gives them this beautiful oasis. He's not like me. Then, they're hungry. So they grumble against him again. And what does he do? Gives them quail at night, manna in the morning, knowing that they're going to disobey, not once, but twice. But he's still feeding them. He's still extending grace and mercy to them. So even through all this, it's hard to miss the fact that God is being long-suffering and gracious and merciful to them. I think when we think about that for us, we should see the same thing. We should see that God is gracious and merciful with us, even when we, quote, fail the test. Even when we don't trust Him the way that we're supposed to. Even when we disobey. And the reason, I believe, is because His goal is to teach us to trust Him and obey. He knows us. He knows our nature. He knows we're going to struggle. Now, that shouldn't give us license to sin. It's not like we should say, I get it. I don't have to. So what? No big deal. I didn't obey. God's gracious and merciful, and He'll... No, we don't find that anywhere in the Scriptures. But that's one response we could have, but it shouldn't. Well, Paul tells us in Romans that it's the kindness of God that leads us to repentance. And so God is gracious and merciful even when we don't deserve it, even when we fail the test. Sometimes we grumble, sometimes we don't trust Him, sometimes we don't obey. But hopefully, as God extends mercy and grace to us, we respond to that mercy and grace and His goodness, His provision. We respond by learning to trust Him, stopping our grumbling or learning not to grumble as often. I tell you, I'll be real. Okay, this is an opportunity for transparency here. I had a rough week. And it's stupid things, just stupid things. I've got a freezer that is giving me fits at home because it chimes every, it's just out of the blue, just... And it's been a known issue with this particular model of freezer, but it's never really been much of an issue. And I had researched it in the past. Not a big issue, just annoying, right? No real fix for it. You talk to Whirlpool technicians, and they're like, oh, what that is? Well, they released some service bulletin on it a few years ago. We've identified the problem. You know, here's a $75 part to fix it if you want, but don't really have to. You can just unplug this, all this stuff, right? Well, what they didn't say in there is that if you let that go on too long, then it does become an issue because it keeps the freezer from going through its cycles properly so it doesn't defrost off. So the other day, I pulled it apart and two hair dryers in the hands for 30 minutes, melting all the ice, you know, and get all that done, put it back together. It starts to freeze again, like, but now it's not. And I think left this morning and it's at 25 degrees. And I replaced a part, and I did some other stuff. I'll be tearing it apart today to thaw everything out again to try to figure out what's going on. And I'll have to admit, there were times where I was grumbling, and there were things coming out of my... I don't have an anger issue except with inanimate objects. You will rarely, if ever, see me blow up at somebody. Now, that doesn't mean it hasn't happened, but usually it's the inanimate objects that get my attention that way. And I knew what I was doing, and I'm grumbling, and I'm complaining, and I'm saying things that are not nice, and then I'm praying at night. I'm like, Lord, I hate that about. I know better, and I shouldn't do. And then the next day, the same thing happened again. Well, then on top of that, I had some phone issues. I've actually had three different brand new phones this week, on the phone with Verizon for 5-6 hours total because there's some issues on that, and so I'm dealing with that, and I need my phone for work. I can't work if I don't have my phone because everything, all the two-factor stuff, the communicate, everything is my phone, and I'm so stressed. I'm going through this, and I'm just, you know, and I know I was sinning with my attitude and the stuff that I was saying and the fact that I wasn't very nice to my phone or the freezer, and I hate that. I wish after 40 years of knowing Christ, God would just take that and remove it. But I think He's just taken the slow road, you know, and chipping away at me. But if there's any hope in any of that, there were moments yesterday when I was replacing the sensor and I'm kind of going, it doesn't seem to be fixing it. I'm gritting my teeth and I'm like, okay, Lord, I shouldn't be doing that and I shouldn't say unkind things. I should not be, okay, whew, behave. Don't let it get, don't do things you're going to regret. But I still, you know, so my point in just sharing that is I fail the test. Even after walking with the Lord for 40 years. And I do think He just tested. I don't think this is any coincidence. I think the Lord was like, you ain't fixing that freezer because I need to do something in you. You love your phone. Well, guess what? You're not going to love it so much this week. Because He's got to teach me something. God, teach me to control that temper, control that whatever goes on in the heart. So it's a goofy example, but it nonetheless kind of tells us that we're all going to fail the test. We shouldn't get discouraged by it, because he's gracious and merciful. And that grace and that mercy, that kindness should lead us to repentance. Amen? The last thing that I think we see here, Yahweh had Moses take some of this manna and put it aside. Now, what's interesting about this is, remember, the manna, if you kept it overnight, it would develop worms. But the Lord specifically says, yeah, but we're going to take some of that manna, we're going to keep it for 40 years, and it's not going to rot. I'm going to have you put it aside as a memorial for future generations so that they can see the evidence that you can trust me. So the last point is that Moses set aside some of the manna to serve as a reminder of how they could trust the Lord. Look at verses 31 through 36. The house of Israel named it manna. And it was like coriander seed, white, and its taste was like the wafers with honey. Then Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer full, that's again 2 or 3 quarts, of it be kept throughout your generations, that they may see the bread that I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer full of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. The sons of Israel ate the manna 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. That's the land of Canaan. They ate the manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. Now an omer is a tenth of an ephah. So we learn a little bit more about this manna here. It's called manna because that's basically the phrase, what is it? Okay, we'll call it, what is it? So they named it manna. It was like coriander seed, except it was white, and it kind of tasted like little wafers when they would bake it. That was real sweet. So like a sweetbread almost. And so the Lord tells them to take that manna that they're going to be eating for 40 years, and he says to set some of it aside for a memorial. And it's kind of interesting what they do. They take an omer of it, and they put it in a jar, and they put it with the testimony before Yahweh. What's that testimony? Anybody know? It's the law, it's the Ten Commandments, if you will, the stone tablets that Moses brought down from the mountain. Those stone tablets were placed into the Ark of the Covenant, and that's where they were supposed to place this omer of manna, inside the Ark of the Covenant as well, in a jar. Now there's one other, anybody know what the other thing that was that ultimately gets put in the Ark of the Covenant? The staff of Aaron, yeah, gets put in that. So there's those three things. And that would stay in that tabernacle as a witness. So you would have the stone tablets, you would have the omer, and then you would have Aaron's rod. And the purpose for doing this was so that it would serve as a reminder for future generations. Now, why is that important? Well, it's kind of where we get our takeaway from this morning. One of the things that fosters trust and obedience, especially through trials and testing, is remembering what the Lord has done. We've repeated that so many times in our time here at Renew. The importance of remembering what the Lord has done. And part of the reason for doing that is because it fosters obedience. It fosters trust. When we know what God has done and remember what God has done for us, it should cause us to go, wow, I can trust Him. I can obey Him. And that's exactly what the Lord did with these remembrances. In the Old Testament, saints like Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Joshua, David, even others, used to set up these monuments. There's over 2 dozen monuments set up by Old Testament saints to remind them of what God had done for them. And you can go look at those. Like I said, there's over 2 dozen of them, or almost 2 dozen of them in the Old Testament. Stone pillars, rock piles, things that they've done so that not only they would remember, so that when Israel would travel and see them, oh, that's where David did this, and that's where the Lord did this. They were to serve as reminders. Yahweh even instructed Israel to establish yearly festivals. We talked about this a few weeks ago. You remember what those yearly festivals were? They were all designed to point them back to the Exodus and forward to Christ. The first one was Passover. Second one was the Feast of Unleavened Bread they're supposed to celebrate every year. The last one was the Sanctification of the Firstborn. All of those ordinances were designed to serve as reminders of what the Lord had done, specifically at the Exodus, but ultimately for Israel. Here he commands Moses to set aside some of this manna. Why? To remind future generations. When our people wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, the Lord provided for their every need. He gave them meat at night. He gave them bread in the morning. Deuteronomy chapter 8 tells us their shoes didn't wear out. Their feet didn't even hurt. Their clothes didn't wear out. Man, if I had a pair of clothes that lasted 40 years... Dustin and I are getting ready to go out to the East Coast here to see some stuff. And I made a comment to him on Friday morning as we were planning part of it, that we're going to do a lot of walking, but it won't be as much walking as we did in D.C. because we have to drive between the sites. And so like every day there's like a drive an hour, and then there's 3 hours later that night. I'm kind of looking forward to that because, man, my feet, by I think the third day in Washington, were absolutely killing me. We've had that at Disney before, where you get to the third day and you're like, I don't think I can do this. I'm rubbing muscle cream on them. I'm pumping down Tylenol, you know. I'm praying almost every step. They wandered for 40 years in the wilderness and their feet didn't hurt. God tells them that specifically. And so this manna was supposed to let these future generations know the Lord provided every step of the way, everything they needed. And because of that, you can trust Him. You should trust Him not just with the things that He says, but you should trust Him in the way that you obey Him. When He tells you to do this, do it. You can trust Him. And it should serve as a reminder. That same thing is true for us. Remembering what God has done for us, especially during difficult times or through times of testing and trial, should teach us to trust Him even more. Should teach us to obey Him. We should never doubt when the Word says do this, and we go, man, we should trust it. We should learn to walk in His ways. That's what this is all about. Again, we're going to repeat some concepts here. We saw this last week. We see it this week. We'll see it again next week. This is all about learning to walk and to trust the Lord and recognize that He can provide for every need. And He does this even when we fail because He's gracious and merciful. Try to figure that balance out sometimes. You know, a lot of us are parents. Try to figure this out with our kids. When do we exercise discipline? When do we exercise mercy and grace? We literally have those discussions with our kids. But you know what? You should get a spanking for this today, but Daddy's going to extend grace and mercy to you, hoping that Daddy's kindness leads you to repentance. But if it doesn't, guess what? Spanking's back on the table. It'll be a time of trial, a time of testing for you. Because what my heart really is I want you as children to learn to walk in obedience, to trust us. And the Lord does the same thing with us. James again says that we can consider it joy when we're tried. Why? Knowing is what it says. Knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. Some translations translate that as because you know. What's James doing there? He's saying, remember the last trial? Remember? You know what the Lord does with these trials. You know He uses them to build endurance. You know He uses them to build your faith. So this time as you go through the trial, remember that. You know what the Lord is doing through all of this. This is one reason for the ordinance of the Lord's Supper. Did you ever think about that? Why does the Lord have us remember His death and not His resurrection? Ever wonder that? We celebrate. I mean, we do. We have Easter, right? But specifically, Jesus really only gave us those ordinances of baptism and celebrating the Lord's Supper. And in the Lord's Supper, He says we're celebrating His, or remembering His death. You know why I think that is? And this is, I'm going to speculate here. I think the reason He does that is because if we remember what it cost Him, and if we remember what He did when we least deserved it, if we can trust Him with that, what can we not trust Him with? If He was willing to do that and take care of my greatest need, what need will He not take care of today? How foolish we are to grumble and complain, to whine, to wonder, to worry, when He's already shown us, look at what I did. What makes you think in your puny mind that I can't do anything else for you and that I wouldn't do anything else. What makes you think if I took care of that need at such an amazing cost, the rest of it cost me nothing? Because I have already paid the cost. Taking care of your daily needs cost me nothing. Why wouldn't I do it? It's like Israel coming out of Egypt, seeing all the amazing things God did and said, oh, he did all those amazing things and he's just going to kill us in the wilderness. He did all that to bury us in sand. Does that make any sense to anybody? But that's kind of the way we behave sometimes. So as we think about the passage this week, and again, we're going to see this sort of repetition, but maybe it's because we need to hear it three times. Israel certainly did, 10 times. The whole point of what's happening here is the Lord is testing them because he's not trying to figure out whether they're going to obey him. They know they're not. When you see that phrase, I'm going to test you to know what's in your hearts. What he's really saying is, I know what's in your hearts. I'm going to try to work that out of your heart. So that's why we're here, right? He could have sucked us up with the giant Hoover when we got saved. Okay, job's done, you're out of here. But no, instead he left us here to go through the trials and the suffering, the difficulties, in part to teach us to trust him, to obey him, to prepare us for, in the case of Israel, going into the land of Canaan, but for us, into all eternity with Christ. This is all training. This is all preparing. This is all working out the kinks, if you will. This is all chipping away at us, making us more like Christ. And again, it's a weird thing to discuss because there's part of that that happens at salvation, there's part of it that happens right now, but the final part of that becoming like Christ is ultimately done supernaturally when we see Christ. So, we're here. We're in the wilderness in some respects. God is allowing us to be tested. Just like Israel, we may fail the test, but God is gracious and merciful. May that lead us to repentance. Amen?